I decided to emigrate from Iran and to go to a place where people accept me and give me opportunity to find myself as a human being and to develop my abilities and talent as I wish. So I emigrated. I have crossed many countries, Iran, Turkey, and Greece.
This is the beginning of one of the first podcast episodes produced by refugees from within Camp Karatepe on the Greek island of Lesbos. It's a project that empowers them to both produce and present their own voices and share their own stories with the world.
This is Latitude Adjustment Podcast Academy, and I'm your host Yasser Akbari, coming to you from Moria 2.0 refugee camp on the Greek island of Lesbos.
اگر مایلید که به زبان فارسی این پادکست گوش کنید، لطفاً به دقیقه 14 دقیقه و 42 ثانیه بروید.
If you want to hear this episode in English, then please continue listening. My friends Mohammed.
All this was made possible by the producer of the Latitude Adjustment podcast that highlights underrepresented communities, places and issues around the world. Podcast founder Eric Maddox is our guest today. And I will talk to him about this fascinating project and what it's like to be devoted to creating interglobal dialogue. Welcome to this edition of Journey Stories.
Journey Stories. Geschichten von Flucht und Migration.
Eric, you're currently on Lesbos, on the Greek island of Lesbos. How are things there right now?
That's a very good question. I mean, as with everywhere in the world, it's impacted by COVID. Greece has its own national response to that issue, and I believe that that's dealt with differently in different parts of Greece. So right now, it's not always clear even what the measures are, because it seems like it can almost change day to day, if not week to week here. But there is an ongoing lockdown that's been in place for, I believe, months, ever since I got here in early December, at least. And at the moment, if I am correct, we are not really allowed to go outside after 6 p.m. And really at any point going outside, you need to wear a mask and you need to have a reason to be outside.
And we're talking to each other because you're there for a good reason, because there is an ongoing project of yours that's based in Lesbos. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But before, on a broader scale, if you want, you've devoted much of your life to building bridges of understanding between people, to connect them across borders, physical as well as mental borders, if you want. And one thing you're saying is a lot of the problems that we're facing are reducible to a lack of curiosity. How's that?
Yeah, so I'm sure some people will hear that and just think, oh boy, like this guy just doesn't get it. Like there's people who are suffering from things much more profound than anything curiosity can solve, you know, like just all kinds of government oppression or starvation, war, multi-generational poverty. How is curiosity going to solve those problems? And I want to be clear, when I talk about a lot of the suffering in the world ultimately being reducible to a lack of curiosity, I'm not referring to the people who are suffering, right, for the most part. Some people's suffering could probably be alleviated by being a bit more curious about their conditions and trying to figure out ways to improve them. But I'm really talking about the rest of us, those of us who have the privilege of living in societies where we have the freedom and the free time, most importantly, to ask serious questions about the conditions of other people who maybe don't have those things.
That would be us and the listeners who are listening in this very minute.
Quite possibly, yes, depending on who your audience is. I would definitely include myself in the category of people that have a moral obligation to be more curious.
When you advocate curiosity on our side, what form does it take? What kind of curiosity would you favor?
I mean, at its core, curiosity is fundamentally about questions and really questioning certainty, right? We live in a world where certainty is very prized. And it's understandable why, because certainty can provide us with a certain level of security, or at least the illusion of it, understanding how to define your environment and what your reality is going to look like from one moment to the next or one day to the next. These things are comforting. And there are certain things that, certain ways in which, you know, there are laws, scientific laws and principles that help us to navigate reality in ways that are practical and useful. But there's also a lot of misinformation out there. And there are people who are suffering in silence in many ways because the people who are comfortable have the biggest microphone, right? And they have access to the levers of political power and economic might. And one of the ways that I would say that we should be more curious is asking questions about where our money's getting spent and what's being done in our names. And when I say where money's being spent, what's being done in our names, for the most part, I mean by our governments,
mm-hmm.
right? Or by the industries that define our economic prosperity. So if we're not asking after, you know, where is the source of this level of comfort that I enjoy on a daily basis and our standard of living in our countries. If we're not asking questions about who might actually be paying the price for that, then I think it's a dereliction of our moral responsibility. Those costs are quite possibly, in fact, definitely being borne by other people in places that we don't talk about much and that I think many of us would prefer to just not think about.
So on a very practical level, I go shopping because that's part of what I can do, and I have the money to do so. And I buy myself, say, a t-shirt, but I'm not interested in how that t-shirt is made, by whom, and under what conditions.
That would be a very practical, succinct example, for sure.
So you're in Lesbos right now, but that's not the only place in the world you've been. As a matter of fact, you've been to a whole range of countries. You are originally from California, but you've spent most of your time abroad, from Europe to the Near East, the Middle East, across Asia. A radio interview with you back in the US was titled, "Eric Maddox Creates Interglobal Dialogue." What drives you virtually around the world to do so?
Well, first, I would make one minor correction. I haven't spent most of my life overseas, but I spent most of my time in the last 9 years overseas, for sure. But I did spend the first, you know, two-thirds of my life, three-quarters of my life in the U.S. for the most part, and working in social work and working on issues related to social welfare in my own country. So I am familiar with some of the issues that are related to poverty and lack of access to opportunities in my own national context as well. And it does inform my work abroad in many ways. I couldn't trace it to one particular thing, but the thing that first pops out to me is how I reacted to the events of September 11th, 2001 in my country. I had just graduated from college and, like a lot of Americans, was upset and confused and unsure what to do with myself or how to respond. And I'd also just completed 4 years studying philosophy and classic literature as an undergrad. And that had instilled in me at least some critical thinking skills. And so I decided that, you know, rather than maybe make a rash decision, I should take some time to try and understand the part of the world that was being portrayed as, you know, quote unquote, the other or the enemy. In this case, that meant like Muslim majority countries or the Middle East. And so a year after September 11th, almost exactly, I found myself in Egypt studying Arabic. And I traveled all over Egypt, traveled all over Lebanon, and just wanted to interact with people from, I mean, I feel embarrassed to just use these generalizations, but to say like that context, because it wasn't Egypt that attacked the U.S., but I did have this kind of simplistic view of, you know, where Muslims come from, and that I need to interact with them, and had some very Orientalist and unenlightened views of large swaths of the planet. So my time in the Middle East and that initial trip got me started on asking questions. When I started realizing that my country and my tax dollars as an American were propping up the Mubarak regime there, I had no idea. I mean, I was very naive in many ways. I had no idea that my country was complicit in supporting human rights abuses all over the world in the name of maintaining stability. And a few years later, I found myself in Palestine, so again in the Middle East, as a graduate student, and there living in the West Bank in a refugee camp and bearing witness to the Israeli occupation.
Mm-hmm.
So when I saw these things, I realized I had not been well served by the traditional channels of communication that were available to me as an American and arguably available to us as Westerners, as people living in, you know, Western liberal democracies. And I had thought, I was shocked at this. I thought, well, we live in free societies that champion free speech. So then why wouldn't we be getting the truth when people are free to speak it? And as I started to realize that there's other interests that form the narrative that were largely given in dominant media and political discourse, I felt like I'd been had. I felt like I'd been lied to by the people that I trusted to be my leaders and the truth tellers. And that's kind of where this idea of, you know what, like maybe the people should just be the ones to pursue the truth in diplomatic interactions. And so that's how really the first iteration of this notion of connecting people across borders began. It was the border of my own country between the U.S. and Mexico, and connecting Americans and Mexicans to speak about, you know, how they were perceiving of one another through what they were consuming in the news and what they thought of this wall, literally, that lay between them and the movement of people and drugs in one direction and money and guns in the other. Mm-hmm. And from there, a few months later, well, while that was going on and while I was starting that initiative with Mexico, the uprisings were happening in the Middle East, in North Africa. This was 2011. And I thought, I've got to get back there again. How do I do it? I was a social worker at the time and just kind of launched this concept as a thought experiment. It's called the Virtual Dinner Guest Project. And so I just decided to go for it and just bought a ticket to Beirut in February 2012, so 9 years ago. And I thought I would be gone maybe 3 or 4 months, and it turned into 4 years, really, of nonstop travel, primarily across the Middle East and North Africa, but also with the detour in India at a certain point. I wound up in Syria about 18 months after the war had started there. I wound up in Gaza, spent a lot of time in Egypt and Lebanon, ultimately in Turkey, briefly in Jordan, Tunisia, and then also wound up in India connecting to Pakistan and some other places.
In all these years, you've sat down, because you've just mentioned the Virtual Dinner Guest Project, you've sat down at a lot of physical tables, but enabling people to speak to one another, breaking down distances between borders, countries, like I said in the beginning, mental borders and physical borders, sitting down at a table, enabling people to see each other, hear each other, and speak to each other. What is it about that Virtual Dinner Guest Project? How do they work?
Well, aside from just the description that you've already provided, where people just obviously have an opportunity to see each other and to interact in as close to a normal way as possible, and in a way that I think we've all become more accustomed to in the time of coronavirus.
Yeah, like Zoom, Skype, etc.
Exactly. So aside from that, the reason for using food, I'm not like a foodie guy. I'm not much of a chef. I can feed myself, but not much more. The reason for that was just a simple practical mechanism for creating a level playing field, so to speak. Like no matter what culture you come from or whatever your politics are, your religion, your belief system, we all know what it is to create community around food. You know, it's like arguably the oldest and the most universal social forum there is on the planet.
Sitting down together by the fireside.
Yes. And it also serves a practical psychological function to disarm people. Because once you see that people's humanity is no longer just theoretical, like, of course, like I'm talking to a person, so of course I'm speaking to a human being, but no, they're behaving like a human, just like I do at home. It can be disarming to see people just bouncing their kids on their knees or cramming their face full of food. And these subtle things, I think, can be even subconscious reminders of our shared humanity.
Eric, one specific dinner that comes to mind that I saw on YouTube was between Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and the other half of the people were in the Netherlands, in Rotterdam, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what was it like to connect these two very, very different sets of audiences and have them have dinner together and talk to each other, see each other, hear each other?
Well, let's see. There's been a few iterations of the project from Gaza connecting to the Netherlands. So, and it's been a while since that one. I can tell you what I remember from at least one of those connections. That one of the questions that got asked, because the way these dinners work is that we sit down and we discuss how we're being represented in one another's press by exchanging a news article from our respective countries ahead of time and passing that through the filter of our actual, the experiences of the other side and allow them the opportunity to tell us whether or not what we're reading about them is actually accurate. At the end of these 90-minute discussions and dinner events, each side poses a question to the other side. And that question then becomes the topic of a street film that you make. You take this question to the street to and answer it for the benefit of the people in the other country. But at one point, we were asked a question from Gaza about what would you do if you lived under a military occupation? And we realized walking around and talking to elder people in the Netherlands that this wasn't theoretical, that they had.
Yeah, they remembered how the Nazis occupied their countries within their lifetimes.
Many of them may very well have a living memory of living under occupation. As that occurred to us, we realized like there are things about other people's realities that it can be very different to us in this particular moment in time. And can seem so different and remote that it just almost seems like they're inhabiting an alternate reality until you stop and think like it wasn't so long ago that we were in their shoes. You know, and that also correlates to like my experience in Lesbos and part of my reason for being here. My family arrived on a boat to Greece as refugees before finally making it to the US. And they were coming about 100 years before this moment, but so many of their conditions were similar. And it's informed like not only how I've looked at the people who are coming here in an act of desperation, but it's also informed how I've looked at Greeks. And I've often wondered to myself, like, you know, would my family have made it if Greeks hadn't been kind to them at some point? It's given me pause when I've thought about taking the lazy and easy path of assigning blame, you know, just strictly to one side. Or I shouldn't even say to one side, to one community that's involved. I think the problems here are much bigger than Greece. I think these are EU-wide problems that need an EU solution. I think that the Greeks themselves have been abandoned in many ways. And the Greek government, I don't think, is necessarily doing a good job in how it's addressing the migration issues at all. And it's been used as a tool to embolden some of the worst human impulses. But I do feel that in many ways the Greeks themselves have been abandoned, and Lesbos inside the Greek context itself has also been abandoned by Athens in many ways.
Mm. We're getting close to what actually brings you to Lesbos and the fascinating project that is currently unfolding there. But one last question concerning the dinner project. What made you decide and how does it work to get people from different continents together? Say, how did you find and select people in the Gaza Strip, and how did you find and select their counterparts in Rotterdam, for example? How does that work?
I mean, the shortest answer to that is I often work with institutions, like with small organizations, NGOs, or universities. And so they kind of self-identify. Once you identify a project partner, then from within the community of that organization, you find your participants. And if it's a class, then it's the students in that class.
Yeah. These people tend to be open to discuss controversial ideas. They're experienced in talking to each other, in listening to each other. But generally speaking, we all live in our bubbles. Many of them are created and filtered by social media algorithms. So when you connect people, when you try to create understanding, I guess that also involves people with opposing views, right? Is that even possible?
In the context of the dinners themselves, that was one of the things that I would have thought would be the case when I started doing this, and was even one of my intentions. It was, we need to find the most, like, the outliers. If we can bring the extremes together, then we'll demonstrate that anything is possible if we can get them to sit down and talk to each other. And I had this very kind of idealistic notion that seemed right, because it does make sense in a way. Like, if you can get people at the extremes to speak to one another, then the middle ground should be easier to define, and it should be easier to move forward from there in many ways with people who have more moderate views. But that's not really how things tend to play out. Like, to be honest, the way that people self-identify for projects like these is well, the extremists are busy doing other things. They're busy being extreme. You know, if they're going to come to an event like this, they're more likely to just use it as a platform to shout down other people. So I've never been in a situation where I've had to like disinvite someone for those reasons. They just haven't really demonstrated much of an interest in participating. Now, that said, one person's extreme or radical viewpoint is completely reasonable to somebody else. So we haven't gotten into like what my politics are. And some people might think that like I'm some crazy radical leftist. I don't know. But I've definitely spoken to people who aren't, and I've made space for, I mean, I've made it a part of my life's mission to facilitate and to make space for people who do not share my points of view, and to make these spaces like without a sectarian or partisan agenda. Really, I just believe in the value of creating space for people to share ideas, and that more evil gets done in the world as a result of the assumptions we make about people's perspectives than simply hearing them and disagreeing with them. What I want people to walk away from those encounters with is not necessarily agreement, but a recognition that, you know, we might have differences, but that doesn't mean that they constitute an existential or moral threat to me.
Yeah. So the point is not so much how much do I possibly disagree with you, but what is much more important is let's just talk to each other, because that serves a purpose in itself, doesn't it?
Talking in the sense of recognizing that, look, this person might disagree with me, but they don't. But their disagreement shouldn't be necessarily perceived as a threat, right? Because that's where you start to see the seeds of violence coming from. It's when ignorance starts to shift into being fearful, then people's defensive posture becomes an offensive one, you know, in anticipation of having harm visited upon them. Mm-hmm. And if you can fill that space of ignorance with like at least the amount of information they need to recognize that, look, I don't agree with this person, or we have very different values, but those differences, they're not coming after me. They don't pose a threat to me. It's just different.
Talking about talking, what brings us together is the fact that this is the Journey Stories podcast, and you have a podcast of your own called Latitude Adjustment Podcast. What is your podcast about?
So in a sentence, we highlight underreported issues, places, and communities around the world, and with a special mind to passing the mic to local stakeholders.
And this is exactly sort of like the cue for why you are on Lesvos, right? Because mm-hmm. you've just created a project called the Latitude Adjustment Podcast Academy that aims at giving voices to refugees inside the Kara Tepe camp. And what I really find interesting is that there is a lot of talk about what's going on there by, say, activists, human rights organizations, all very important, but much less is heard from the refugees themselves, right? So the academy is aimed at giving them a voice of and for themselves. Is that right?
That's a big part of it, yes. Absolutely. I don't want to make any claim that we're the only ones who are creating opportunities for refugees on Lesbos to speak their minds. If you check Instagram or like our partners for this project, Refocus Media Labs, they've been here for about 3 years, and part of what they do is giving asylum seekers opportunities to learn videography, photography, and other media skills. So there are people here doing similar work. There are asylum seekers who have taken it upon themselves to create their own social media accounts and to highlight their own stories and the stories of people who are suffering alongside them. So that's important to point out too. Maybe the podcast medium is unique in some ways. That I don't know. The idea for us was that it just seemed to fit with our vision for how we want to bring about change in the world, to not just look for opportunities to interview people that are being overlooked, but to give them the tools to create content on their own. So it's just a natural extension of our mission. If we want to bring attention to underserved or underreported or misrepresented communities and people, one of the best ways to do that is to give them the tools to just continue doing it themselves. You know, we might cover a community once or maybe even several times if we have compelling reasons to go back and do it again. But if they have the opportunity to continue to just make their own content week in and week out, that has its own value. So that's, I mean, the motivation is as simple as that. It's just a continuation of our mission with the show.
There are probably, I imagine, a lot of practical hurdles in setting up this kind of academy, you know, you organizing things from outside because you're not allowed to enter the camp, your students being locked up inside the camp, or also in apartments nearby because there are people who are no longer in the camp, but they still cannot leave the island. So what are the practical hurdles?
I mean, for one, I would also just urge your audience to listen to all of the episodes, because the first one, which is just a preface, is just me talking for about 8 minutes about what we overcame just to pull off the interviews. Because the actual shows that were produced along with the asylum seekers themselves, they're talking about their stories, but not necessarily about the difficulty of actually making the episodes themselves, and the things that we had to overcome in the course of completing the academy. But in short, you've named some of them. So we're already in a condition where, because of coronavirus, like the world is in different places, is under lockdown, and Greece is one of those countries. And then within that context, the asylum seekers who are in the new Karatepe camp, or as many people are calling it Moria 2.0, are locked inside, just as they were in Moria 1.0 before it burned down back in early September. Through the duration of coronavirus, with no access to meaningful hygiene protocols. And I was in the camp, original Moria camp, this time last year. And one of the first thoughts I had when I saw the sanitary conditions there, again, before coronavirus, was this is a public health emergency or disaster just waiting to happen. Like, it's almost been engineered. When you see that there's like just a few filthy toilets for 20,000 people living in the mud, it would just boggle the mind that anybody thought that that was sustainable just purely from a public health standpoint and before we had a pandemic. There's no question that afterward that then locking people inside was just asking for an absolute catastrophe. So the pandemic hasn't gone anywhere. They're in a new location. And when it rains, the camp floods. There's credible grounds to believe that there is a lead contamination problem in the ground in that camp because it's on a former shooting and artillery range for the Greek military. And people can do their own research on what has and hasn't been done with analyzing soil samples from there, or what happens to children if they're exposed to lead contamination. And so that's some of the physical conditions that they're dealing with. They're right next to the sea with winter here. Greece is not Hawaii. It can get very cold here. And because this is on a military or former military post, the pretext of security is being used to prevent really anybody from getting in to monitor what's happening without a lot of controls. So the press more or less forget about it. And if even for NGO workers who are there, shortly after I got here in December, there was a government policy that was put in place that said that even the skeleton crew of NGO workers who are still allowed to go inside the camp, because very few are now allowed to work inside as opposed to the way things were in the original Moria camp, they have an effective gag order where they're not allowed to speak about anything that they see inside. So that should be chilling to anybody who's hearing about these conditions. Some of the things that we had to overcome were these conditions in the camp, the lack of access, the infrastructure issues within the camp, where thanks to Refocus Media Labs, there were some hotspots so that the students could have access to Wi-Fi on their phones, but it wasn't necessarily always reliable. And we taught over Zoom calls on people's phones for 5 weeks, teaching the principles, everything from the principles of journalistic integrity to editing and how to promote your podcast when it's done. And to add to that, I'd say roughly 70% of our class did not speak English at a level that would have allowed them to follow the course in English. So we had other students who were doing simultaneous translation over Zoom calls, over a spotty internet connection into the camp. Some of them, like while they were on their bus ride home commuting from work because they have a day job, so just on their phones offering translation support to the rest of the group that was spread out in different locations and also accessing the classes over Zoom. So that's I'm probably leaving out some things too, but I've been in a lot of places and taken on some fairly sizable challenges in trying to complete independent media projects, and this ranks up near the top.
And that seems about as far away as the sun from the moon when it comes to organizing a podcast academy.
Yes.
But the point is that at the end of the day, podcasts have been created. They are there. They are on air, if you so want. Does all this make you proud, happy, wondrous?
I'm very proud of what the students produced along with us. And their persistence. There's no way that this would have been completed without their dedication and their total commitment. So I want to make that very clear. And the amount of time that was donated by the students just in the form of translation support, not to mention all the other ways that they kind of had to rally to support one another to make this happen. I'm very proud of them. And I will let people be the judge of what they've learned from the podcasts. I am proud of them. I think that like what they represent is overcoming, like they and themselves as having been created represent like having overcome a lot. And then there's the story that they tell that people need to hear. You know, there's a story behind it, but people need to hear what they have to say. It's critical.
And for these stories to be heard, we're inviting our audience to tune into the Latitude Adjustment podcast homepage and listen to them, right?
Yeah, that's latitudeadjustmentpod.com. And just click on the tab for Academy, Podcast Academy.
And there you have them. I will put that into the show notes, of course, and invite our listeners to listen in on these incredible stories that these people have to tell. What's the next step?
What we've done now is we want to scale this up and to offer it here in Lesvos more in the future, and we want to offer it in more places. And so what's next is we're trying to find supports. So if people want to get behind this initiative and help us to bring it to more people, we have a GoFundMe campaign that's up. You can find that on our website as well on the homepage if you want to support us bringing this to more people. And I'm continuing also, of course, with my partner, Leila Mochaiber, my co-host, to continue to produce our own podcasts. So we're making our own episodes too. One, the Podcast Academy has not replaced our podcast. It's just one more initiative.
So from one podcast producer to another, this might very well not be the last time that we're in touch with each other, talking to each other, exchanging ideas, and making sure that these stories can be heard. Eric, thank you very much for talking to you today. It was a great pleasure to hear about this very intriguing, very interesting project. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you for the opportunity, Peter. Appreciate it.
Okay, talk soon then. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Right,
thank you.
That's the end of our show for today. And that is the end of our first podcast. Thank you for taking time to listen to us as we shared a very small part of our realities with you. We know many of you will hear this episode and feel sad, but you may also feel confused about what you can do to help us. So we would like to share some suggestions and our final thoughts with you in our own voices.
We ask you to put pressure on UNHCR and on the European Union to increase the speed of the asylum process and to decrease the time that refugees have to wait in the camp.
We ask you to use your social media channels, your Instagram, your Twitter, and your Facebook accounts to start raising awareness and to campaign for us. Help us get this camp closed and help us to get the refugees out of here.
We want people to support smaller but more effective NGOs instead of the big ones, because we've seen much more help from the smaller ones. We hope this new year bring more hope for all of us, and that it also takes us out of this camp, off of this island, and to a place where we can start our lives again in safety and in a good mental health. Until next time, we are the Latitude Adjustment Podcast Academy.
So, listeners, I urge you very much to check out lateraladjustmentpod.com
and find out more about the Academy and the podcasts that have been produced so far. You'll find all the details in the show notes of this episode. There's more to come from Lesbos. We'll keep on reporting. For now, it's time to say that our signature tune is called Rain, Rain, Go Away from @NOP. Bye for now.
Journey Stories. Geschichten von Flucht und Migration.